This is a Deese World production in association with Pants Pending Studios.
Hey, it's Burr Martin, the internet selfie dad. Join me and my wife as we talk about all the weird news from around the world.
Mirror reports a married couple have slammed strangers for assuming their grandfather and granddaughter because of their 30-year age gap. Defiant Chelsea, 22, says they're happier than ever after the first meeting in a coffee shop. Bruce, a 52-year-old retired car dealer, offered his recommendations on coffee, and the pair hit it off from there. They say that...
Hey, recommend a good bean. I guess you get a hot chick.
Wow. Gave her the hot bean. They say that they've been inseparable ever since they met. Bruce said, I never thought someone Chelsea's age would be interested in me. She has an old soul. Insider.
Wow. I just knew that there were some really bad jokes rolling around. No, you just grabbed out both hands, white knuckles, didn't you?
Name of his 60.
So subscribe now to the Burr Martin Experience podcast. It's a weird world out there. Let's laugh at it together.
You are now listening to The Social Hour.
They're not PC. So if occasional foul language turns you off, then you have all been warned. This is the calm before the storm.
The best reality check you can ever get in life is seeing the people that dating apps suggest to you.
Get ready for the social hour.
Live from Deese World Studios in Spokane, Washington, this is the Social Hour. On today's show, from the podcast Aged Like Milk, Paris Herbert Taylor. And now your host, he's aged like wine, boxed wine that is, Deese Casillas.
Mullum Keen, everyone, welcome to the show. This is the Social Hour. I am Deese. You know that. Thanks for coming around for another episode, guys. We got a good show for you in store from the Age Like Milk podcast. Paris Herbert Taylor coming at you. We talk all about movies and her show and living internationally and all kinds of fun stuff. That was a very interesting guest. We connected on social media. I was glad to get to talk to her and really gain some perspective. She was born in Australia and then kind of grew up in Hong Kong, among other places, and traveled abroad and ended up in L.A. And that was a podcast, which you should listen to. I listened to a couple episodes of their show. They review movies that maybe didn't age so well, and it's an interesting concept, and it's very well done, and you're going to have a great time hearing what she has to say. As for me, guys, before we get into this show, this Friday, you can find me at the Globe, downtown Spokane. If you're within earshot of where this show is recorded, we're doing a virtual show. We'll be downstairs in the studio broadcasting live to the upstairs audience. So this is kind of live, kind of not. We will be playing a off the cuff, the game where the audience gets to decide what we make jokes about, which is one of my favorite games to play. I really like flexing that muscle and getting the audience to give me suggestions and forcing me to just make jokes about it. I've actually been able to work bits off of that eventually. It's really, really entertaining. Definitely come out. Your suggestion could be pulled and see how we make it funny. I'll be there with a couple of my comedian buddies. So come check it out, guys. And as always, go to pantspending.com. Check out all the shows on the network. Go to Patreon.com/pantspending. You can subscribe or do a one-time donation. Get some exclusive behind-the-scenes Patreon-exclusive content. And if you like what I do, guys, the Social Minute, Social Hour, Sketch Comedy, all the great content we bring you daily here at the Social Hour Comedy, you can subscribe at DeeseComedy.com. You can subscribe, donate also, or you can go to Deese-Casillas on Venmo and kick in a couple bucks to let me know you love me. Leave a little note. Tell me what it was you liked. Was it a social minute? Was it a social hour? Was it a fantastic meme? Was it a picture of my dog? Because my dog is pretty fucking cute and worth some money. But I wouldn't sell her. I would. But the price is high. Anyway, we'll talk about that later. All right, guys. We're going to get into it now. Again, great guest. Awesome conversation. Awesome show. Check it out. Age Like Milk. Find them on Instagram, Facebook, and more. You'll get information from her directly. Paris Herbert Taylor. Here you go. Well, it's not too serious. We'll just kind of talk about what you do. And, you know, I wing it, man. Just wing it. That's my favorite way to do life. I've managed to make it this far I do not prepare for anything in life. And I think that's probably very evident with how my life has gone. But it's interesting, right? I mean, that's one way to do it.
Totally.
So Paris, you're in LA now. I was listening to your podcast. You guys have two episodes up currently, the Age Like Milk show, where you guys talk about movies that maybe didn't age the best.
Yes.
So I do want to talk about that, but I also give me your elevator pitch on that. And then I have so many questions because, like, looking at your Instagram and hearing you talk about, like, where you grew up and how you grew up, I'm so fascinated by, like, this journey you've been on. But give us the elevator pitch of the show before we get any further so the listeners can get that down.
And we kind of connected on social media. You know, I'm new to podcasting, but there seems to be this whole, like, network of people who are making content for your ear holes. And, you know, it's a very exciting medium. And especially during quarantine, it's something you can do by yourself from home. But yes, I was watching a terrible movie, actually. Well, not terrible, but I was watching a movie, an old classic that we will be reviewing on the show coming up. It was the Disney version of Dumbo. Okay.
The animated. Okay, I guess that's the classic. Yeah. The new one. Yeah, yeah. That probably doesn't.
That's the classic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was watching it and I was just like, oh, wow. There's a lot of things in the film that are like, just kind of like, what the heck? You know, I mean, it's from the 30s. So you're like, okay. Anyway, I was watching this movie and I'm sitting there and I'm just like, that would just so, you know, and they recently came out with a new one in 2019.
Yeah.
So I then went and watched that one, which has addressed a lot of the problems. But I was like, I was like, it's so interesting. And I've been, you know, we're in quarantine. So I've been a lot of like old movie binge and I've been watching a lot of like Audrey Hepburn films, which we, you know, just sort of talked about Breakfast at Tiffany's recently-ish.
Right.
And, you know, just thinking about how like, no filmmaker, even back in the 30s, I don't think any filmmaker went in and was like, I'm going to make something that's going to age horribly. They were making something that was, you know, current at the time. So then I was just sort of thinking like, wow, this is really, I don't know if you guys have that expression, but like aged like milk, where, you know, you buy it. Mm-hmm. It's got like an expiration date on it. You try to use it. I know in our house, you know, we have almond milk, we have half and half in the fridge. And like, sometimes you forget about it and then it goes bad over time. So that was kind of the concept for the podcast. And I've got a buddy who's also a bit of a film geek. His name's David Rogers. He's my co-host. And we're both trying to make it in the film industry. He's an actor, a wannabe actor. I'm a wannabe producer, writer. And we always talk about movies. And I kind of told him about this experience. And I was like, I kind of want to do a podcast about it. And he was all on board for it. So since diving into it, I don't want to say it's ruined movies for me, but like I'm watching movies and I'm like,
you're like looking to be critical. I mean, that's like what the job now, right?
Right. So that's kind of, I mean, but we have fun with it. I mean, we're always drinking when we make the podcast. Like it's LA and it's also the quarantine. And we also, you know, are friends. So we just have a few boozes and then we kind of get talking and it's like, it's funny. It's fun. I mean, sometimes it's not funny. Sometimes it's like horrifically racist or horrifically like, you know, against like trans people or whatever. But like, I think that's how we grow as a society. Like we kind of like pull something up culturally that was like Dumbo is like really important to me as a kid. I loved that movie. And then watching it as an adult, you're like, oh my goodness, like, does this still have a place for our kids in the future?
That's an interesting question because, yeah, Dumbo specifically is a good example because, I mean, you have to realize, like you said, it was made in the 30s. I mean, we were a decade removed from World War II before this happened. Like, we were, you know, I mean, we were closer to, like, abolishing slavery than we were now. You know, I mean, like, you're talking about a way, way different time in America. And, you know, there's some very what we can call problematic parts of Dumbo, you know, like the crows, obviously, you know, that scene in the end. Did you watch the unedited, like, because now they have like the neutered version on Disney Plus where they edited those parts out. So I assume it was the original version you watched.
Yeah, we did. Yes. Disney recently came out and said that they were going to Disney Plus, I believe. So they were going to. You know, and they've got, but actually Dumbo on Disney Plus had this like disclaimer where it was like, this is, you know, problematic, or I forget what the exact wording was, but basically it was like, you know, this is a product of its time. Go ahead.
I mean, what's your take on that? Because for me, I feel like there's, you know, we have to look at things through the prism of the time it was made. I mean, if we can't look at it now and be like, obviously, we've evolved, and that was a time where we had less sophisticated views. It doesn't mean those are our current views or we're perpetuating that. You know, should we live with that, or is it better that they are editing it and softening the blow?
It's a great question, and it's an interesting topic of discussion. And I think, I don't know, I think we need to have the tools to understand that there is a prism now, because, you know, someone watching the film sort of without knowing that, like, American cinema has, you know, obviously evolved and we're all about inclusivity now, might be a bit more like thrown, because it's really, and then but then maybe people wouldn't even notice it. Like, I'm kind of in two camps. I think we need to signpost it, because I think we need to show younger kids, which obviously Dumbo is targeted at, you know, children, that things are different now, and that this was problematic because of this. Like, I would hope that any parent, you know, sitting down with a kid that could string a cohesive sentence together would be like, listen, this was it's a fun movie. It was only the third movie ever made by Disney, but this is why, you know, it's problematic. I mean, kids don't know what Jim Crow is, but there's literally a crow in the movie named Jim.
They're not hiding it real well. I mean, to be fair, Walt Disney was a well-known anti-Semitic piece of shit. So, like, that we built a child amusement park around. It is an interesting, like, juxtaposition in America where, you know, the crazy part is because, you know, like, America was built on the foundation of racist pieces of shit. So, like, they're kind of stuck in our history. And it's like, well, there's only so much of it we can erase before we're like, we don't have anything in the history books that happened before 1992. Like, what we kind of have to be able to, like you said, be able to understand it was a different time, but also, parents, you're going to have to actually have a conversation with your kids, which I know disgusts you. like be a parent for a second and, you know, be like, hey, this is how it was. It's not that way anymore. Or, like, we're trying to change things, you know?
But, you know, it's weird as well. Like, I work in the film industry, which I know you want to hear a little bit more about my experience, but you know, with this, like, with a film, so much has to go through so many channels. Sometimes I watch things that are, like, not that old, because it kind of feels like Disney is a cheap shot. Like, there's a lot of stuff, anything before, like, 1970 feels almost like, you know, we did Breakfast at Tiffany's, and it was like horrifically racist portrayal of a Japanese American man. played by Mickey Rooney. And it's like, you know, that comedy slapstick, like, there were multiple writers, there were people dressing this guy, there were people doing read-throughs, and you're like, no one thought to sit down and be like, hang on a second, you know, like, because, I mean, in some ways also, like, film and Hollywood exist in a bubble where, you know, the average person may not have had such a diverse upbringing, and they're like, oh, why would this be offensive? So it's kind of a twofold where it's like, you're looking at the content of being like, this is of its time, but it's also like, there were a lot of people making active choices to make this product.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, that's true. And on top of that, part of why that was is because, you know, there was a time when, I mean, again, when, I mean, when was Breakfast at Tiffany's made? You just watched that.
I 1960, I want to, I'm going to screw it up, but the 1960s.
Oh, wow. Okay. Later than I thought. But yeah, that, so maybe not as much of an excuse, but it is in, not to excuse any of it, obviously, but like, right. You know, again, there's, it's such a crazy thing that like, you know, people don't realize like when you, it's part of this, people in, you know, you're probably experienced that in LA, there's a big division obviously between, you know, with Black Lives Matter and everything going on in America and Trump as president and kind of this division of people in America. And there's a whole swath of people that can't even like look back and be like, they're like, oh, racism doesn't exist. And you're like, dude, it was like 20 years ago we were making crazy movies that were still pretty racist. Like, not even that long ago, probably, you know. You know,
for those people, I think it's like racism hasn't been a problem because it hasn't affected them
exactly.
necessarily.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, as terrible as 2020 is, and I agree that it's been like just one hell of a year. in some ways, it's really, I think, woken people up. You know, I hate that expression woke, but it's useful because it's sure. like people who were asleep to the problems that minorities were experiencing or people with darker skin were experiencing are suddenly going, it's like in their faces on the news.
And, right.
And some people have taken the opposite view of like, well, this is only a problem now because of, you know, pointing fingers. But some people who were maybe a bit more apathetic, like I put my hand up straight in the air and say, I was very on the fence about like politics. And I was very like, oh, it's not that bad. And then to really see it and to really listen, which I think is the huge thing.
Yeah.
Realizing, and then yes, of course, finding the prism and my medium is the podcast and the film and really like examining that and being like, wow, this is, you kind of said it before, like it's been deeply entrenched in not just American culture because we can't just hold you guys
sure.
up. That's a problem.
Yeah.
Worldwide, you know, it's been an evolution of compassion and breaking down stereotypes and stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, that's kind of to me, again, I mean, we don't want to glorify the missteps that were taken in film and other medium and things like that. But I think erasing it is kind of doing it a disservice. And also like, you know, we have to kind of understand that like, hey, this is what we were, that we look at it now and understand it wasn't right. But It was kind of the current climate, you know, like why erasing it doesn't make it not happen. It just makes people feel a little better about themselves.
Right.
Or like, I think people want to erase it and be like, now we don't have to talk about it. It never happened. It's like, well, it did still happen. You know, there were some pretty bad things that people did. We should be able to like look at those objectively and be like, all right, well, we don't want to do that again, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, that's basically our podcast is we have kind of an interesting perspective because we're living inside the Hollywood bubble as
yeah.
well. After the third episode, so we kind of pre-record our episodes as a lot of people in podcasting do, because you have to make sure there's nothing that like goes wrong and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's not radio. It can't really be as live, but we decided to start bringing in industry guests because, you know, we know people out here. And so it's really interesting as well to get other people's experiences and opinions, especially people who've worked on a lot of film. You know, you can be a film fan, which I consider myself to be a critique and a film fan first and foremost. But then you go and work in a film and you're like, just realizing like what a huge undertaking it is and how long it takes. And so, you know, that's why we always end off our podcast kind of like shouting out someone random from the credits, because it is a group effort. And
oh,
you know, imagine if you were one of those animators working on Dumbo and it was your big break, and then you kind of slowly watch in horror over time as like it becomes less and less culturally relevant.
Yeah, you're like, you know, you're like, oh man, I designed that crow.
Yeah, like, exactly. I wrote the dialogue for that crow, which now is right. horribly. I wrote the song to the Roustabouts, which yeah. is like the most racist song ever. It's like so terrible, but yes. So that's our podcast. It kind of, I mean, Corona sucks. Everybody's, you know, underemployed and sick and people are dying and it's the worst. I think for me creatively, it gave me, I just came off a movie. I got back to LA mid-February, and then like literally it all happened. But it really gave me pause to figure out what it was creatively that I wanted to do. And I had really not been putting out anything of my own. So to have, you know, we're only a couple episodes in, as you mentioned, but like to have something that I'm working towards actively, something that brings me joy, something that's getting my voice out there too, is huge. And so I'm very grateful in some ways to be, you know, fun employed, as I keep calling it.
Yeah.
Like the work will come back, basically.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, that's kind of the creative spirit. I think people who are in kind of the creative industries, truly embedded in committed, pivot and find something that's going to keep them satisfied. It may not be the paycheck. It may not be kind of what they're used to, but also you can kind of do things that you enjoy a little more, and kind of, they're still creative and fun and entertaining. You know, it's not the A to B paycheck necessarily, but you know, you're still doing things you love and involved in an industry you enjoy also. So
totally.
So with the movies, so far you've selected a couple. You know, it was She's All That was the first one. I listened to that whole episode, and then
oh, thank you.
Yeah, of course. That was, it's really interesting because I love film also, and I definitely am like, I don't have a podcast about it, but I judge a lot because it's my right as an American.
Yes. Free speech.
Right. You know, to be a pompous, uneducated asshole is the right of an American.
Totally.
And I definitely have that same experience with a lot of films over the years that people have a ton of reverence for, and I'm like, I don't know, I'm like, I feel like that's like a right place, right time movie. There's a lot of films that like, oh, you were 15, dumb and stoned when you saw this movie, and now you love it forever. Like, if you saw this movie as an adult, this is not a great film. And I feel like She's All That, you know, is on not even just the writing, but there were a lot of again problematic things that you guys brought up that as I started thinking about listening to that episode, I'm like, oh yeah, that's you couldn't do that today. Like, that doesn't like the age.
Although you say that, like, you couldn't do that today, they are actually making a new version that just came out recently.
Oh wow.
Remaking it with a gender flip element. So I think David and I were joking about in that how it would be funny if the guy was like the dorky one, and literally I think a couple of weeks ago, I read an article in one of the trade magazines that said, it's happening, baby. So
it's coming, because God damn it, we're Hollywood. We've run out of ideas.
Yeah.
Exactly. So how do we beat something else out of this dead horse? What else can we get out of this?
Exactly.
So do you have, I mean, films coming up, do you not want to reveal them? Do you have movies you're looking
we'll
to do?
Them. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What are some you're looking to do?
So we have recorded and they will be coming out. We usually do every second Tuesday, but I think for the month of October, it's like my birthday month. We're like, we're going to do one a week. And also,
all right,
you know, you know this as well. Like, it's, you want to build the momentum. Like, you get excited about it. It's just, you know, with David and I both being sort of busy, we thought that every second week would be more reasonable, but we're figuring it out. You know, we've had two launched by the time this podcast that we're recording right now comes out, I think. You know, I think our next one will be out. I don't know. We're doing Avatar. We just did Avatar.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yes. We did Grease, which is quite problematic.
Yeah, I just watched Grease the other night, actually. So.
Yeah, we did Dumbo, which we mentioned, and then the next one that we're recording is Knocked Up. Judd Apatow.
Interesting. Okay. All right. I'd be interesting to hear what the take on that is after some distance, because that's not even that. I'm going to say it's not that old of a movie, but you'll probably tell me it was 20 years ago.
2001?
Yep, there you go. Yeah. Of course, 20 years. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Judd's kids are in it. Judd Apatow's kids, Iris and Maud, and they're like fully grown adults now, and they're in this movie as little kids. Yeah, it's funny. I mean, we're trying to really balance it. So we've got things like, you know, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective on the list coming up. We've got Porky's, 16 Candles.
Porky's was the main one I was going to ask about. That is one that definitely, you want to talk about like basically just a cornucopia of sexual assault and anti-Semitism.
Right.
Forky's.
I haven't seen it yet, so I'm excited to experience it for the first time.
Well Paris, you are in for, I'm not going to call it a treat, but you're in for a journey, that's for sure.
But it's one of those things, right? Like you know, I'm sure when people were watching it at the time, like it seems so fun and whatever. I mean, even Avatar, like I kind of mentioned in the episode that I saw it three times in the cinema with my mom, you know, and it was so amazing. And now as an adult and someone who understands about like Indigenous rights, I can understand how it's like hugely offensive, because basically what we sort of talk about in the podcast is like, you know, this white man savior complex, this guy comes in and like, you know, they're basically pillaging the land. But again, like David and I work in the film industry, so we're not about to just go and shit on someone's like baby, you know, right. Avatar hired a lot of people and it was a very incredible piece of filmmaking. But it's more like, yeah, just acknowledging that things age over time and that we have to be, it's tricky though, because it's art too. Like you don't want to feel like you're so constricted by being so politically correct, but.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, I mean, feel free to shit on it. James Cameron's doing fine. He's going to be all right.
I know, but what if I want him to like hire me one day and then he's like, I know you like made fun of my movie. It's like, no.
Yeah.
Jimbo.
If he won't hire you because you made fun of his movie, it means he heard your podcast and you're doing just fine, Paris. You don't need James Cameron at that point.
Totally.
If he's listening to that, you're like, you're killing it at that point. So
I know, right? Maybe we'll get lucky. Maybe we'll score some big guests because everyone's just bored and at home in the quarantine, and we'll convince them to come on and just shit talk other filmmakers. It'll be great.
Right? Yes. Just have some major guest come in and be like, tell me why Quentin Tarantino's a piece of shit. And right. Then it's just John Travolta there. Yeah, have him come for the Grease episode.
Yeah, and, totally.
So let's talk about you for a minute, because I was like, I was so captivated by your, like trying to figure out like your, by little bits and pieces of things you said, and then your social media. You were born in Australia, is that right?
I was born in Australia, but that's kind of I am Australian, but that being born actually on the soil of Australia was kind of a fluke move, I think.
Okay.
My parents are what some people would call expats. So basically lived overseas for a number of years. I think they were living in, I want to say Singapore, right up until the moment, like pretty much a month before I was born. And they came back to Australia to have me in a familiar country. And, you know, obviously we have this thing in Australia called universal healthcare. Right. It's really great.
Yeah.
People, you know, get sick. They don't go bankrupt. It's awesome.
I have no idea what you're talking about. This yeah. foreign to me.
I think actually Singapore probably has it too, but for whatever reason they wanted to be back. So yes, technically, yes, I was born in Australia, and then my parents returned to Asia. My dad is an architect, although he's like semi-retired now.
Sure.
He's old as fuck. But yeah, so they moved to Macau, actually, right after I was born, which is a country that's like an hour away from Hong Kong. It's, you know, part of Asia, but it at the time was also its own governing body. Macau and Hong Kong Macau was a Portuguese sort of settlement. Hong Kong was a British settlement.
Right.
And we moved to Hong Kong after living in Macau, which is where my brother was born. And then we lived in Malaysia, which is where my other sibling was born. And then, yeah, we lived in Australia for a little bit back in, like, I think I did grade 4 to grade 8 kind of down there, and then back to Hong Kong, and then back to Australia for me. Stop me when this gets boring.
No, well,
and then,
you went to high school in Hong Kong though,
I
correct?
Did. I graduated, I heard you say that.
Yes,
I graduated high school in Hong Kong, which was awesome. So in many ways, I still feel like Hong Kong is home, because I was there for like a lot of
kind of your formative years.
Yeah, and like all my friends were from there, you know, my high school friends. So
what was that experience like? I mean, you know, that it, as far as like language barriers or cultural barriers, I mean, how was it like, was it very easy? I mean, do you speak Japanese or I'm sorry, Hong Kong, Chinese, Chinese, well, actually, or Mandarin or Cantonese, whatever they speak in.
Cantonese is, yeah, no,
sorry.
I do not. I would actually love to learn it as an adult. It's, I mean, Hong Kong at the time, the handover was in 1997, which was where basically like the Brits had this 100-year contract with China that they could have Hong Kong. And
yeah.
So I think up until 1997, You know, it was basically like pretty much everyone spoke English. It was a,
okay.
You know, there were a lot of white people living there, like Westerners, a lot of international schools. It was a, I mean, it's a huge, even now it's a huge, economic center, although recent events have maybe made people sour a little bit on it. But, yeah, so I grew up there. I mean, I went to international schools. We lived, it sounds so weird now. And like, I feel like so much of my writing that I do is like kind of trying to understand this weird, like Stepford life that I had, Stepford wife life, where, you know, we lived in like a, basically like a gated community with other families from other international backgrounds and some wealthy local people. And I went to school with a real mix of kids from around the world and some local kids. Mm-hmm. And it's weird because looking at it now as an adult, again, it's sort of an experience that has aged like milk. Like I, at the time, thought it was so normal to live in a country and not speak the language. And to be able to speak a little bit enough to get around, but to really only exist in my bubbles, which I'm sure, you know, there are pockets here in LA that are very Russian. I happen to live in one. And, you know, there are people that do not speak English or Spanish, you know, and they're getting by. They have, they go to their local, you know, Russian butcher where they speak Russian there. Like maybe their kids speak Russian and or English and can help them. But like, so that was basically my experience, but in reverse, where I, you know, knew enough Cantonese to kind of like get what I needed. And I was learning a little bit, but really lived in a bubble and with other white kids. And, you know, it's funny when you live in a country like that, like I'm a blonde, I have fair skin and I always stuck out. So it was always like, where are you from? Like that's pretty much the defining, even in Australia, I feel like I was asked that because I have kind of a more British accent from like living in international schools, growing up there. You know, where are you from? And you never felt like you belonged, even though, you know, my brother was born in Hong Kong. He has a Hong Kong tattoo. You don't get a passport if you're foreign. It's similar to Japan. You can never be like a full citizen of that country, but you get like a permanent residency type card.
Sure.
You know, it was very obvious that we were not Chinese, you know, like, and I, go ahead.
So like living, you know, growing up in all those international places and then how long have you been in America for?
I've been in the US for, in January it'd be 4 years, but prior to living in LA, I lived in Toronto for 6 years.
Okay. So you kind of,
I've done North America and I'm 10 years in.
Yeah. slowly integrating into, you know, go to Canada, then make your way into America.
Yes, exactly.
What perspective wise, I mean, growing up internationally and in a myriad of places and probably gaining a lot of different cultural experiences, how does America, this is kind of a broad question, but I guess how does America compare to other countries with like, you know, multicultural interactions between other races or cultures, I guess.
It's a good question. I think America, I mean, this is the funny thing. Like, even though I had never lived in America until I was 27 or something, mm-hmm. I felt like American culture had always permeated my life because, you know, in Hong Kong, America has been this like very defining cultural mega country that, you know, everything, you know, we had MTV in Hong Kong and like we also had MTV Malaysia and MTV Hong Kong and Singapore, but like we also had MTV America. So like I knew some things that like were probably like very normal to you growing up, but not everything.
Okay.
But in terms of like multiculturalism, I mean, America is quite, depending where you live, like it's so different. I live in LA, which is a very multicultural city. Mm-hmm. I was in Pittsburgh for 6 months on a movie, not so multicultural, like quite, you know, there were a lot of Polish immigrants there. So you got a lot of Polish food, but like, you know, same with, I have to say like the most multicultural place I've ever personally lived was Toronto. It was a very like blended society.
Yeah, Toronto is very much, I was going to say, that's got to be, as far as, I mean, I've been up there. It's definitely a melting pot compared to even America.
Totally. And I mean, the only other place that I've ever felt that same melting pot vibe was London, England, where, but you know, Australia has its problems. America has its problems. I don't think it's necessarily that that we're not melted. It's just that similar to my upbringing in Hong Kong, people kind of carve themselves these little like areas so that you know, in LA, we've got like kind of a Russian area in West Hollywood, which is where I live. We've got like Koreatown. Like, it's in the fucking name.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, you get all over to Alvaro Street or up off the 210. There's the Armenian, you know.
Right. There's little Thai town. Yeah. There's like, you know, and it's the same in Australia, although not necessarily, although, yeah, I mean, I feel like every country has like a Chinatown, or every city has a Chinatown or a Greek town. I mean, Toronto has those things too, but it's more, I don't know, it's more blended up there. Here, and in Hong Kong, of course, it was super obvious because they were like the Western places where like the Westerners hung out. It was like the more upscale, you know, air-conditioned malls. And then you have like the local flea markets and stuff like that in the, you know, in side streets. And that's not to say that white people couldn't go there, like we did and we could, but it's funny how people find their people. Like, I definitely had a lot of Australian friends in Hong Kong. You know, we did Australian stuff. Like, if a new Australian family moved into town, like we shared our Australian products with them. You know, it's this like weird, like searching for a home thing. And now that I'm in the US, I crave dim sum. You know, we do Chinese food.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was the same when we lived in Australia, we would go for dim sum every Sunday. And you know, and what I wouldn't, and we went to Australia last year, my boyfriend and I went to Australia last year, and we bought all this Australian stuff to bring back to America. So it's like this weird, you know, and a lot of my friends in LA are Australian, weirdly enough. Like, it's just this weird, I think it's a natural human thing where you're always looking for the connection to someone else.
Yeah, it is that kind of tribalism, you know, right. Which, like, it's funny because, like I mentioned earlier, I grew up in LA, specifically east side of Long Beach, which in the 80s was an interesting place. I mean, I'm Mexican. I grew up around mostly Mexicans, blacks, and Filipinos, right? That was my neighborhood. Like, I literally didn't see white people until I was in my mid-teens. And when I moved to Washington State, even, like, I live in Spokane, Washington now is where I'm based out of, which it's on the eastern side of Washington State, close to the Idaho border. So, you know, I found all the white people. but also, like, it's so funny, within a couple years of living here, I realized I'm like, oh, like, I found every Mexican and black person that lives here, and those are my friends. Like, that's like, right. And like, it just happened to be like, I'm like, oh, that's what I grew up with and was like comfortable. Not to say that, I mean, I don't have white friends here too. But yeah, you just kind of gravitate towards like what's natural or what you're used to, you know?
Totally. So. And that's like, yeah, it's hard because like, I understand people that want to find those commonalities, you know, like there's people here who like, they seek out the Australian meat pie cafes, you know, there's a coffee shop in near me that I like support because they've got Lamingtons, which is this like Australian tea cake, essentially, that's like toasted in, rolled in chocolate and coconut. But it's just those, yeah, it's just those familiarities. And then it's like finding the people. I feel lucky in LA because I feel like the whole city is my people because everybody's creative, everybody's a filmmaker, everybody's, you know, working hard. And I have to say, like, in terms of, I feel more at home in LA than I ever have anywhere else in the world, which is so bizarre.
Wow. Yeah.
But it's just because I found my industry and I found the people working as hard as me, creating as much as I am. So I don't know that it's necessarily a cultural thing. It might be like a spiritual soul thing. I don't know.
That makes sense. And now, I mean, and you went from Toronto to LA. I mean, I know Toronto has kind of a film industry also. Were you working in Toronto in film? Is that
how I was?
So
I was.
Yeah. Tell me about how you kind of ended up in Toronto and then LA. I mean, that's got to be an interesting kind of dynamic there.
So I ended up in Toronto completely kind of randomly. I did my degree in Sydney. I actually did 2 degrees in a very short amount of time just because the way the Australian system is set up. I did my bachelor's in 3 years and then my master's was only a year. So I'm like 22. Wow. I've got fucking master's degree in creative writing. I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. And
got master's and free healthcare. We get it. Australia's great. Humble brag.
I know. And I during my master's, I had interned first and then got on a job on a reality TV show down there. But when it ended, I was kind of a bit lost. And I went back to Hong Kong for 6 months to hang out with my mom. And I was a TA at my old high school. And very lost. And then my friend was like, I'm going to go work at a summer camp in just outside Toronto, and they're still hiring a theater head. You should totally try and get in. And I had run like a lot of theater programs in university and like done them in high school and stuff. So I applied and I got the job and got the visa. There's a visa reciprocation between any of the Commonwealth countries. So UK, Canada, Australia, it's great. And I went for what I thought was going to be 2 months and ended up staying, yeah, almost 6 years.
Wow.
And, you know, just while I was up there, I mean, I had my one reality TV show under my belt. Anytime you move to any new country or any new city, you kind of have to start all over again because you have to make those connections and stuff.
Sure. Yeah.
So I just started interning everywhere. There was a local TV station called Rogers TV, which was like when you turned on the TV to go to cable, it was like, you know, that channel that popped up. And I started on there and I like worked my way up to being like on camera and like got to, you know, learn all about cameras and stuff like that, like how to run a live show. And then just started, you know, doing whatever job kind of came my way. I signed up, and this is something I recommend for anyone that's interested in getting into the entertainment industry. I signed up with a temp agency.
Okay.
And I told them that entertainment was my passion. And I was just really friendly about it. And I was always like following up. And so anytime there was like a placement in a entertainment sort of, you know, world, I feel like I was always the top of the list. And so I got like a temp job at this company called E1, which is pretty big. They do a lot of like TV and film. You've probably seen their logo.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Started off there in the publicity department as a temp, got offered a full-time job in their TV department. At the same time, I was also as a temp put on this, I was introduced to this woman who was like, I just need someone to run the doors for the Toronto Film Festival. She was like running parties. She and I really hit it off, and she was based in LA and was like, I do Sundance, Cannes, the BAFTAs, the Oscars, Emmys, like all this shit. And she was like, you know, so TIFF is in September usually. And so this is like September 2012. And she's like, do you want to come to Sundance in January with me? And I thought like, I thought I was coming for free, or I thought I would have to pay her.
Sure.
No, she was paying me like a really, really weekly rate. I mean, I was working insane hours, yeah. But I was at Sundance, and I did that. I followed her like basically around the globe for like 5 years, making connections. And then like every time I would go back to Toronto, I would take like another sort of like temporary assignment in another company. So I'm like at the same time as I'm like jetting off every 3 or 4 months to these places, I'm also working at places like E1. I got a job at Pinewood Studios, which is at the time I was working there. They were shooting the first episode, the first season of Schitt's Creek, which just won a bunch of Emmys.
Yeah.
For those guys.
Yeah.
They were shooting Man Seeking Woman and they were shooting Suicide Squad. So I'm like around all these people. And then I got a job, a full-time job as a film publicist from just making connections. I met these women who started a company that they were like, you have everything it takes to be a publicist. We'll train you. Come join us. And so I kind of left the events world. I still helped out in the Toronto stuff, but like I left it behind and worked as a publicist for like over a year. And I worked on films like Room, which ended up winning TIFF. I worked on The Witch. I worked on like all these campaigns for these movies. And I will never forget like chatting with a friend who was a Canadian that had made the jump to LA.
Yeah.
And she was just, you know, Canadian winters are just terrible.
Right.
Like it's yeah. 6 months of
just oppressive.
Oh my God. You get fat, you get depressed. And I'd been coming out to LA like a couple of times a year just to visit and whatever. And my friend was like, you know, I moved out here. And then, I had met an Australian at the Cannes Film Festival, like I think that same year. And she sent me all this information on like how to get a visa in the US. Cause it's not easy. If you're not American, it's not easy to live in this country. People that get mad about immigrants, I'm like, literally, like, it's so fucking difficult. Even me as a master's having first language English, you know, like has lived around the world. It was
yeah.
one of the hardest things I've ever done. But yeah, so she was like, you should come out, blah, blah, blah. I actually got offered a job at the industry magazine Deadline, which then the job offer went away as soon as Trump got elected because they were a bit scared they just didn't want to do the paperwork and whatever.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, what a difference that it's so telling how quickly, you know, that can make a difference in the zeitgeist and culture, just kind of the fabric of the country and the direction, you know, how, you know, a job goes away that quickly. It's like you said, masters having first language English, you're like, you know, despite what anyone would like to say about people trying to come to this country and your stance on immigration, it's like, okay, maybe you don't want some people coming here, but like, if who does get to come here? If you want, if you're complaining that it's the wrong people, maybe that's the right person at least.
Or maybe make it like so that it's not as difficult. So, but yeah, I mean, I think it's just going to be ironic because I think depending on which way you feel politically, like with what's happening with the election in November, I think some people are going to try to leave the U.S. and they're going to suddenly realize that holy shit, it's actually really fucking hot. Like, you know, people are always saying like, well, I'm just going to move to Canada, and I'm like, good luck with that, because right. even me as an Australian, you know, we have a reciprocation of visas. I ran into some serious issues after 4 years. I had to become a permanent resident and it cost, you know, $6,000. And it was Jeez. Like, they wanted to know every address I had lived at in the last 10 years. They wanted to know like, what, you know, you had to do like fingerprints and blood tests. Like it is not easy. So anytime you meet a non-American immigrant in this country, give them a hug, because like, the amount of money they've had to pay either for visa stuff, like we're just going through my green card application is like processing right now, and it's just a wait and see kind of situation. But same deal, like our lawyer fees were like over $6,000. Like it is not a cheap process, and it's a stressful process. And anyway, that's my little rant.
Yeah. But, well, no. I mean, that's definitely worth talking about, and something people probably don't realize is how difficult and challenging it is, and costly, not, you know, among other things. So yeah, when people actually struggle to get here and, you know, go through the whole process, you're like, yeah, you have no idea what people actually went through to get there.
There's so much immigrant, I just call it immigrant tax, whether it's a lawyer's fee or like missing out on jobs because you don't have the right visa. Like my previous visas have been tied to companies, you know? So it's like, if I'm unhappy, I really have to weigh up, like, can I get a job in the allotted amount of time? You know, can I leave this job?
Yeah.
But yeah, so I didn't get the deadline job. They said, sorry. So I said, okay. So I started applying, you know, for other jobs, thankfully found an event because I did have quite an extensive amount of experience and I knew quite a few people, got a job, at a event, more of an events job, and came out here. But around this time as well, I was starting to think like, I love doing events. I love doing public relations. But I want to have my own projects, you know, and it was amazing. I was in the room with all these filmmakers and like meeting them. And, you know, speaking of Quentin, like I've met him, like I'm talking to these people that are like my fucking icons when it comes to filmmaking. And they're asking me where the bathrooms are, or they're like asking me what time the next interview is. Yeah. And so I came out to LA, I worked for a year in events, and I was like, I did it. Like I moved to America. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. I moved to LA, which is like, you know, not an easy city to live in. You need a car, you need to have money. You got to hustle. And I just said, fuck it. I want to make movies. And so kind of my best option was to go down a few steps career-wise to like learn from someone who, you know, had, made movies. So yeah. I went like the assistant route, although I was never like the assistant because it's really hard to get a visa as that. I was more like coordinating and all this stuff. And I thankfully, you know, worked for a great company that was doing branded content. And then I made a jump after a year again, because in this industry, you kind of have to jump around to get places. I met this producer who was like really dynamic, and he had just worked on a show called Daybreak on Netflix that was about to come out. It only got the one season, but it's a really good show.
I haven't heard of it though.
It's a really good show. It's got Matthew Broderick in it. It's kind of got a nod to Ferris Bueller. Like what would happen if basically the world ended and only the teenagers were left, and like, you know, it's kind of fun. It's a bit gory. But anyway, I met this producer. He gave me a shot and was like, come with me to Pittsburgh. We're making this movie with Jason Momoa. And I was like, okay, I'm there. And so, I lived in Pittsburgh for 6 months and literally learned how a movie went from like, you know, a few meetings and stuff to like, I'm on set driving a Tahoe, driving my boss to places, sitting in meetings, listening to how we're going to make blood look real in the water. And just, so that's where I'm at now. And fun, Yeah.
Oh, sorry. You were going to say fun.
I was just going to say, and then now I'm just fun employed because, you know, Corona happened and no one's making movies.
But
so.
You got a podcast. You got a podcast, Age Like Milk, that comes out every other Tuesday, but possibly more in October.
Yes, we'll see.
I love that story. Thanks for sharing all that, Paris. That's very, very encouraging and also like a really interesting. I love the kind of finding out where people come from and what got them to where they are now. Part of the reason I do this show. But one of the things I really pick up on that it's like how much work you had to do and sacrifice and like deciding to take a job that's maybe a downgrade, but also from what you were doing, but looking at it as a springboard to something bigger in the future. And I think also that this is really telling of like other cultures, I think, and how much better they are than Americans. because like I speak from my experience in comedy and, I've been doing comedy in some form or fashion for about 15 years now. And it's the type of thing where, like, literally you will spend the first 3 to 5 years of your career driving like 5 hours to do 7 minutes of stage time for $25 in a drink coupon, you know, like, and that's on a good night, you know, you're just. And it's those things where you're like, I'm doing this because hopefully down the road this club likes me, and then like now we have a relationship. And I think it would be that's such an important thing that I wish more people looked at as like not instant gratification. Like I'm throwing track down the road. Like these are things I'm doing for a couple years from now. You know, like looking long term instead of like, hey, this isn't. I'm doing A, so I need B right now or tomorrow. It's like, well, no, you know, you it may not be an exact A to B. You may not even get to B. You may start doing a number system soon, and it can be wildly different. But it's progress, you know?
Yeah, and I talk to a lot of, people are always like, oh, you did it. And it's like, I think what my upbringing sort of gave me as an edge over other people is that like, I'm not attached to places. I'm aware that like you move, you come back, like things are still there. Like,
yeah, totally.
It seems really crazy for a lot of people to uproot their lives and try and find a new life somewhere else. But, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. And if you don't try, then you never will. You know, I was in a situation where I was dating someone in Canada. I had a very nice apartment. I had a very nice job where, you know, and I found myself hitting my head against the ceiling in Canada and being like, I just want more. And it was a huge gamble to come to LA, but maybe that's what I like about the people that live out here. Like, cause very, very rare to meet someone that was actually born and raised in LA. I mean, you don't live in LA.
Yeah, there's a lot of transient people.
A lot of transplants. And everybody that moves out here wants to be here and is trying to do something.
Right.
So.
Yeah, everyone who is there wants, you know, moves out there, and everyone who grows up there moves away.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird cycle. It strikes me that. And this is my experience from, I've done a lot of international traveling, and I found in my experience that like I meet a lot of Australians and Canadians and Germans, especially those three countries stand out to me, that travel a ton internationally. And it could be partly they have more time off because of the way their work system is, but also I feel like they take an importance in that. I mean, I have friends who've never been out of like Washington State, really. They just don't, you know, Americans seem to grow up in this bubble of like, I don't know, like, you know, people in LA, people I knew in LA, they're like, I go to Vegas once a year and that's what I do. And I'm like, have you ever thought about going to another country and like experiencing something? And I think that is a marker of people who are adventurous, but also like, driven, because they want to see an experience, and those are the people that really like gain some perspective and are able to overcome obstacles and accomplish what they want to do.
I will say, you know, I've thought about this too, because there's a lot of Australians that haven't traveled. It's similar to the US, and it's the same with Canada as well, by the way, if I can say this with confidence from having lived up
there.
Sure,
yeah.
People on the coastal, like people on the outsides of countries, for whatever reason, tend to be the more travel-y type. Like, don't you know, you've met a lot of Australians overseas. There are a lot of Australians out here, and the Australians that you guys are exposed to, like the Chris Hemsworths of the world, the Margot Robbies, like all of these people come from, you know, kind of like wealthier backgrounds, and they all exist on the coasts of the countries. Like, we certainly have our version of the middle states in Australia, and
sure.
So does Canada.
Yeah,
and
what's Australia's Nebraska? Like, you've got
yeah.
Like, just
well, we only have like 7 states,
yeah.
To be honest. We didn't break them up too much like you guys did.
It's easier that way to keep track,
yeah,
of them.
Something like that. But I mean, yeah, so it's like, I don't know what it is. I think it's probably something to do with like the education level or like what you were exposed to as a kid. Like, if you come from like a wealthier background, like, I'm very much aware that like the amount of traveling I have done and the amount of risks that I've been able to take have partly been because my parents are there to back me up. Like, if something goes completely shit, like, I have another country I can go to, you know. Not everybody,
yeah,
has that same privilege. And also, you know, it is partly, I think, the education. Like, you guys in America, your country is so huge and every part of it looks so different that like, you don't need to go to another country to go skiing. You can go to,
yeah, it's true,
you know, Colorado or whatever. Like, Australia is very is ocean locked, and I don't know what the excuse is for Canada. I guess they're just like very like, you know, they like traveling up there, maybe because it's so cold all the time. They're like,
yeah,
I gotta get out of here. But yeah, it's,
yeah,
I do think that more Americans should travel and sort of break down. But the problem with Americans I have found is that you guys have been the cultural pinnacle for so long that the Americans that I have met traveling, I hate to say it, but you guys have such a bad reputation. It's,
oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, like, do you guys take American money here? It's like, nah, bruh, you're in France. They take euros.
Yeah.
Like, do a Google. Like, Jesus, we've all got the same internet access.
That's,
you know,
there's this great meme I saw a while back about, like, you know, you're, we'll just say, we'll call them conservatives because that's what they are, conservatives in America, who are like, you know, you're in my country, speak English. And then anytime they travel anywhere else, they're like, does anyone here speak English?
Yeah.
Like, come on. Yeah, that's kind of what I loved about my big thing when I traveled was like, this is your country. Like, I want to respect your country and your culture. Like, I would try to immerse myself in what was the most like basically like old school kind of like cultural pinnacle I could get in that area. I didn't want, you know, I don't want to go to Costa Rica and go to a resort. Like, I want to go to Costa Rica and go to the middle of the jungle and like,
right,
figure out what this country is about. I think, yeah, a lot of Americans just kind of they're scared of that, or yeah, kind of expect everyone to cater to them.
But it's, you know, it goes both ways, and we've kind of come full circle in the conversation here. But like, you know, living in Hong Kong, like, I definitely stuck to the Western things that I knew. I mean, I definitely was more adventurous and go places with my local friends. But, you know, we can look at it here in America too. Like, there is a Koreatown, and in, I don't know if you guys have ever seen like when these big Chinese tour groups come through town, like they all get out of the bus and,
yeah,
they all speak Chinese to each other, and then they go to the Chinese restaurants that they know and like the tour guides kind of lead them. It's almost like when traveling, people need that some kind of familiarity. So I don't want to shit too much on the Americans like overseas, because I'm like, okay, you're here, so that's like step one.
That's step
like you
one.
Did it, good for you.
Yeah, I'll still shit on them, but
yeah,
you